May it please the court.
Certainly.
Dual representation of co-defendants presents such a grave risk of adversely affecting the client that ordinarily attorneys shouldn't undertake such representation. Missouri Supreme Court Rule 4 prohibits dual representation of co-defendants in certain circumstances, and recognizing the potential harm that could result from dual representation of co-defendants, the law imposes a duty on the trial court to inquire into conflicts that it knows or has reason to know exist. In this case, we have the textbook example of what happens when counsel runs afoul of the rules of professional conduct and when the trial court neglects its duty to inquire into conflicts about which it has a reason to know exist or which it knows exist. In this instance, counsel divided his loyalties between Natalie and her co-defendant brother, David, and an actual conflict of interest arose. Now, there were a number of special circumstances that had to exist in order for this conflict of interest to arise. One of those circumstances was the evidence in the case. The evidence against them indicated that one co-defendant was more culpable than the other. That is, that David was more culpable than Natalie in that the marijuana and the rifle that formed the basis for the charges against both of them were found in areas of the apartment over which David had primary control, his bathroom and his bedroom. The other circumstance that had to exist in order for this conflict of interest to arise is that counsel who presumably reviewed the evidence against both of the co-defendants came to the belief that one should go to trial whereas the other should plead guilty. Counsel believed that Natalie would fare better if she went to trial because of the lack of evidence against her. And he believed that David should try to negotiate for a good plea deal and plead guilty because of the amount of evidence against him indicating that he had knowledge of the substances and knew of its illegal nature. Now, in a situation in which those two circumstances existed, the prosecutor continually made package plea deals, the acceptance of which was conditioned upon both of the co-defendants pleading guilty. And those three circumstances come together to create a conflict of interest. And the reason is that in order to obtain the benefit of the deal, one would have to sacrifice the best interest for the other. It was in Natalie's best interest to go to trial, but in order for David to get the benefit of the plea bargain, she would have to sacrifice her best interest and plead guilty. For that reason, there was a conflict of interest, and the interest of both co-defendants were adverse. Now, the conflict of interest came into being when the first package deal was offered by the prosecuting attorney. That first package deal should have put counsel on notice that there was a conflict of interest of which he needed to advise both co-defendants. And reasonably competent counsel would have advised them of the conflict of interest.
Could they have waived their conflict of interest?
In this particular instance, I don't think the conflict of interest is waivable because there is an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected counsel's performance in this case. And the court can, even if there is a waiver, the court can refuse to accept a waiver where there is an actual conflict of interest. And the fact that there is a waiver in this case doesn't end the inquiry.
Did counsel actually state that he felt it was in her best interest to go to trial at some point in this record?
Did he believe that Natalie?
Yeah, did he actually make that statement?
He indicated that he did not believe that if she went to trial that the state could prove her guilty. That he stated in letters that he didn't think she was guilty, and he also stated in letters to her that he didn't think she was guilty of felonious activity.
Because she got the benefit of pleading by having certain charges dropped, right?
She did get a benefit of pleading. Conflict of interest is apparent at each instance in which the prosecutor actually makes a package plea deal. The next instance is where the prosecutor announces an intention to offer a plea deal for Natalie to testify against David. There, again, counsel should have been alerted to the fact that there was a conflict of interest, and that's because he has a duty to David not to engage in such a plea negotiation that would harm him. And then with the last plea offer that you mentioned, Judge Draper, the prosecutor conditioned Natalie receiving the side plea offer for a discharge or dismissal of count 3 and reinstatement of her bond on David entering an open plea. And it was not in David's best interest to enter an open plea, given the amount of evidence against him. It would more than likely have been in his best interest to have pled guilty to a negotiated plea deal. But yet, he had to give up something there.
Did the defense counsel have any explanation for why he did this?
I don't believe that there is anything in the amended motion that indicates that counsel had an explanation for this, because he was never asked to explain.
Because you want an evidentiary hearing in which that can be explored.
I think that in this particular instance, given that there is an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected counsel's performance, and the trial court had reason to know or knew that the conflict of interest existed and didn't inquire into it, I do believe that there is a basis for vacating the plea in this particular instance and not remanding for an evidentiary hearing.
If we find there was an actual conflict, you're saying as a matter of law, then we would have to reverse. And are there other circumstances in which it should be sent down for a hearing?
Well, if this court believes that it is believes that we have not shown that there was both an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected counsel's performance and that the trial court neglected its duty to inquire into conflicts of interest that it knows or has reason to know exist, if the court determines that those two things don't exist in this case, then they need, in the alternative, we would ask for an evidentiary.
What about is this the one with the group pleas where the
Yes, in this particular case, this is a group plea where the two co-defendants pled guilty in the presence of five other criminal defendants en masse. And this court has disapproved the use of the group plea procedure, indicating that it is not the preferred procedure. And the Eastern District Court of Appeals has used stronger language to describe it as being inconsistent with the ideals of justice and it being abhorrent to use the group plea procedure. But in this particular case, the trial court's use of the group plea procedure is what caused the trial court not to be alerted to the conflict of interest and not to conduct the inquiry into it before accepting any pleas or any dispositions in the case. Now, the court had reason to know or knew about the conflict of interest because there were disclosures that were made prior to and at the plea that should have put him on notice of this. There were disclosures made on record that Natalie and David were both represented by the same counsel. There were disclosures made on record indicating that one was more culpable than the other. And there was also indicated on record prior to the acceptance of the pleas that there was a negotiated packaged plea deal that was the acceptance of which was contingent on both of them pleading guilty. So the court would have known all those things. And those are special circumstances that could have or should have alerted the court to actually conduct an inquiry and to take some appropriate actions, such as appointing separate counsel in this case. But again, the group plea procedure only contributed to the trial court's failure in its duty.
Even if they had pled individually or just the two of them together, you'd still be arguing that the presence of an actual conflict prior to the plea should result in the plea being vacated, wouldn't you?
I'm sorry, restate your question.
Well, is the group plea element really necessary to your argument? Wouldn't you still be saying that the actual conflict required the court to vacate the plea even if they had pled individually?
I would. I would think that if there is an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected the performance, then Natalie is entitled to relief.
You're saying it's another error because the trial court has an obligation that you think the trial court didn't realize it had because of the nature of the group plea.
Right. What
but
I'm saying is
error.
That ordinarily, in situations such as this, when there is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel based on a conflict of interest, in those instances where the court goes up to a court of review and there hasn't been an evidentiary hearing, the court typically remands for an evidentiary hearing. What I'm arguing is that this is a special circumstance in this case because we are alleging not only that counsel was ineffective and that he labored under an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected his performance, but also that because of the use of the group plea procedure, the trial court failed to conduct an inquiry that it was required to conduct by law. And for that reason, that the plea should be vacated, because both of those things did not occur. Now, if it were actually proven, of course, that counsel was, in fact, ineffective for laboring under an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected his performance, then Natalie is definitely entitled not only to an evidentiary hearing, but she's entitled to outright relief. Now, the way in which this...
Your time is up.
Oh.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
May it please the court.
Certainly.
Before the court should, before the integrity of counsel should be impugned by allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel and failure to follow the professional rules, there should be facts alleged showing that counsel's performance was adversely affected by the alleged conflict of interest that arose in the case.
You can't waive an actual conflict, though, can you?
You can waive,
conflict.
You can waive an actual conflict, but I think that there's some case law that says some conflicts we will not allow to be waived because the rights of the defendant would be so adversely affected that we're just not going to allow it to occur.
Which is this one?
I think not, Your Honor. I think that there are certainly potential conflicts of interest that are aroused or that could come up.
Was this private counsel?
Yes, it was.
And so it's possible there could have been a savings of attorney's fees because of group representation?
It's possible, Your Honor. I don't know what the fee arrangement was.
Did he actually waive?
Do people have the constitutional right to select their counsel?
They do, Your Honor. They do.
Don't we have a case? Their conflict here?
They signed a waiver according to the allegations in the amended motion. The allegations in the amended motion are brief with regard to the waiver, but there is an acknowledgement that they did sign a waiver.
Well, counsel, I know we had a case here where a father was paying for the defense of his son, and we said that was an actual conflict because the alternative to the son doing it was that the father may have done the crime, and we said that's an actual conflict, which even though the son agreed to, could not be waived.
I agree. There are circumstances where the court would step in and say that there are conflicts that cannot be waived.
Well, here, where an offer was made that would have required her testimony against her brother and counsel represented both, why isn't that a
No such offer was made, Your Honor.
Okay.
There were allegations in the motion that the prosecutor talked about such an offer, but there was no allegation that an offer was actually issued to the defense along those lines. So the potential for a conflict was out there, and I can hypothesize and imagine many circumstances in which that conflict could come to fruition and there could be an actual conflict of interest. And I can also hypothesize the next step, which is that counsel then failed to do something or did something that was adverse to the to one or both of these clients, to the in service to the interest of the other. But what we don't have in this case is an actual allegation along those lines. What we have in this case are allegations of circumstances that arose over a two-year period of time without any discussion of what the client's interests, what Ms. DePriest's interests were at any given moment in this case, but mere conjecture and supposition about what might have been her best interests.
What about the group plea issue?
I think the group plea issue in this case arises sort of in a separate arena, but they've been tied together because there's an allegation that the group plea somehow prevented the court from becoming aware that this conflict existed.
Well, actually, they said the court should have been aware it was in there, but didn't inquire into it.
Well, that's what she argues today, but that's not what she alleged in the amended motion. In the amended motion, she alleged that if it had not been in a group plea, then the court may have asked questions that would have brought to light
Right.
and would have made the court aware of the conflict. She did not allege that the court should have been aware of the conflict and thus had an affirmative obligation to inquire. That's a slightly different claim than the claim that was alleged in the amended motion. The amended motion speculated that different questions would have been asked and thus brought to light this potential conflict and then required the court to do something about the conflict.
Well, there's a litany of questions the judge asks taking a plea that might have elicited the issues involved in the case.
Well, one could speculate that it would happen, that might have happened in an individual plea, but I don't think there's a reasonable probability of that because the litany of questions or the general questions that are required, there's no specific litany, but the general questions that are required under cases like Boykins versus Alabama, which require that the guilty plea be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, were all asked in this case. Rule 2402B was complied with in this case, because the trial court asked each defendant these questions, and the trial court personally addressed each defendant in these cases. Now, granted, there were several defendants at the guilty plea hearing, and at various points, certain questions were asked of each one, and they responded down the line and said, yes, Your Honor, or whatever their answer was. But the court still complied with 2402 by personally addressing each defendant and ascertaining whether the guilty plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. There's no reason to believe that the court would have asked a different line of questions in an individual guilty plea.
Certainly, but with others all saying the same thing, wasn't there parroting?
Well, that's one of the concerns that courts have brought up with regard to group guilty pleas, is that a defendant might be inclined to simply parrot the answers of the previous defendant. In this case, there was no allegation in the amended motion that the defendant merely parroted the answers of anyone. There was no allegation that the defendant was confused or didn't understand the proceedings. There was rather an allegation that a group plea is per se invalid and that it violates Rule 2402B to engage in a group plea. But there's nothing in our rule that says that, and this court in Roberts rejected the notion that a group plea is per se invalid and automatically renders a guilty plea invalid.
We also said it shouldn't be done.
You said that it's not the preferred practice. That's correct. And I think that certainly courts around the state should take that into account when they're deciding whether they should do a group plea. I think the fact remains that group pleas are conducted to save time, and in light of the crowded dockets that exist throughout the state, it's not surprising that it's employed from time to time. But the key really should be And I think that what probably must have governed this court's rejection of the notion that it would automatically invalidate a group plea, the key is whether the defendant's guilty plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And that's going to rest upon a defendant coming and making allegations of fact showing that the plea that the defendant entered was, in fact, not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. For instance, the defendant could have said, you know, what really happened in this case is I didn't know what was going on, but everybody else said yes, so I said yes. I didn't understand the court's question, but everybody else seemed to understand, and I didn't want to appear stupid, so I said yes. But there's simply not any allegation
along
those
lines.
Well, and
of course, here they say the problem is the conflict, and because they had conflicted counsel, they didn't understand the conflict. Counsel had explained conflict to them in a very narrow way, and they didn't understand what was happening to them until too late after that.
Well, whether they understood the conflict is, I think, a separate question from whether they understood the group plea proceeding. And I was trying to address
whether I understand.
The group plea proceeding was itself a violation.
And the nature of her complaint about the group plea proceeding is that it masked this conflict and didn't provide an avenue for it to come out because it's not the client's job to understand the attorney has a conflict. It's the attorney's job to have that and to make it clear what the rules are to the client.
Well, and that would be that's something that I could hypothesize as well. The amended motion didn't hypothesize it. The amended motion didn't say anything about the steps counsel took to advise them about the conflict, the potential conflicts that arose in this case.
Isn't this a case, though, that requires a hearing?
Well,
I mean, all the things we're talking about, we're speculating over when, in fact, on the face, there was a conflict of interest in representing both, which could have been adequately explained or not. Or the question is, legally, could it have been adequately explained? But doesn't that require a hearing?
I think a hearing is only required if the allegations show both an actual conflict of interest and deficient performance by counsel. And under Mickens versus Taylor, that is the standard. It's not.
Well, if you have that, why do you need a hearing?
Well, because you need a hearing to prove those facts. You allege the facts first, and then you hold a hearing to prove that those facts exist. And what we don't have here is anything saying, for instance, when I pleaded guilty, I did not understand X, Y, and Z about my guilty plea. I didn't understand how that was contrary to my interest to agree to this because it was actually favorable to the defendant at my expense. There's absolutely not a single allegation along those lines.
Judge Fisher raised a very good point about not going to raise the cost on people being able to afford attorneys, but at what point would you need to have independent counsel so that you understand that they would understand that they're waiving their rights,
well,
to waive in your conflict?
I think that it's difficult to say when someone would need independent counsel, and I think that's why we rely on the defendant to allege facts showing when the defendant's interests, whatever they might have been throughout this two-year period, diverged from the interests of the co-actor.
And so what if we were to find that there was an actual conflict of interest on this record, or it appeared there might be? Then would a hearing be required?
I think it's not difficult to imagine that there's an actual conflict of interest that could have come about. I think that the allegations in this case show that there are that potential conflicts abound. And depending on what counsel did or did not do, what advice counsel did or did not give, all of which is not described in the motion, incidentally, there could have been an actual conflict that affected the performance of counsel. And if the court believes that the allegations in this case are sufficient to raise that specter, then yes, an evidentiary hearing should be ordered because the allegations themselves are not self-proving, which is why we require them up front so the court can look at the allegations, make an independent determination whether, if as alleged and true, the defendant's entitled to relief, then yes, we need to hold an evidentiary hearing, at which point the defendant can then actually prove what occurred between the defendants and the attorney in this case. In this case, quite frankly, if the court remands, and I can understand how the court could be concerned by the potential conflicts in this case. I think that there are potential conflicts in this case. But quite frankly, if the court were to remand under the allegations in the amended motion, I don't know what we would be remanding to prove, what facts in particular we'd be remanding to prove. It could be that we'd be remanding to prove that counsel failed to tell somebody, for instance, that you are you shouldn't plead guilty to this one because really I negotiated it because it was going to help out the other client.
Is there any responsibility on the judge to see a red flag when they have the two people, brother and sister, and they're not committing the same crime? Is there any red flags that the judge should have seen?
I think that, as the court acknowledged, I believe it was in Holloway versus Arkansas, you know, basically, anytime you have co-actors who are charged together, there is a high probability of a potential conflict of interest. But the court later made plain in Kyler versus Sullivan that the trial court does not have an independent obligation to question about potential conflicts, because in the ordinary case, we rely on counsel to bring those to the court's attention. We rely on counsel to be ethical and to have integrity and to follow the professional rules and bring those to the court's attention in a timely manner. When counsel does not, the presumption is that there wasn't a conflict that hampered counsel's performance.
And there are allegations here, whether they're self-proving or require a hearing or as a matter of law, of conflicts, of advice, that they stay in lockstep, even though in the next case the argument is there was a great deal offered up front that was not taken because it was part of a package, and that Natalie would have been better off in going to trial rather than taking this claim later, taking this offer later on. There are many allegations which you contest maybe some of the facts of, but they allege a conflict in treating them as an all or nothing package for both, where their interests, because their potential culpability, were very different. So I'm not clear why you're saying there's nothing alleged here that could be found to be the basis for a conflict of interest.
Well, I think that in the appellant's brief, certainly there are arguments along the lines of them being in lockstep and being advised in lockstep, but those allegations don't appear in the amended motion. What appears in the amended motion is an allegation, for instance, that counsel advised them, you know, wrote in a letter they advised them not to accept an offer. Now, what isn't alleged in the amended motion is that that was somehow contrary to either one, either defendant's interest. And in particular, because it doesn't really matter if for purposes of Natalie DePriest, it doesn't really matter whether counsel did something to David DePriest's detriment. What matters for Ms. DePriest is whether counsel did something to her detriment. And what we don't have is any allegation that the advice of counsel as to any offer that was extended by the state was deficient as to Ms. DePriest and was serving the interest of somebody else. Now, the
What about the evidence which is cited that says that he told her he thought he might be able to get an acquittal because there was no evidence she had possession of the narcotics that were found, but they were found in the house in her brother's rooms.
Which is
consistent. So it puts them in a very different position.
Well, it puts them in different positions, but it doesn't change the fact that counsel's advice to Ms. DePriest was, don't plead guilty. That's what counsel's advice, according to the allegations, the amended motion, was, don't plead guilty.
And
there wasn't any allegation in the amended motion that counsel at some point said to Ms. DePriest, you need to accept this plea because it's in your best interest, and by the way, I'm not going to tell you that it's going to help your brother. She didn't allege that.
It's a shame. It would be inappropriate. We have an expert in the field in Alan Pratzel, but we can't ask him to come forward.
Well, I've done my best, Your Honor. I hope that the court
job.
Will consider my arguments.
You did a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In response, counsel did advise both Natalie and David to accept the negotiated plea offer for the open plea in the last instance. So counsel did do and did advise them contrary to their interest again.
And that's alleged in the amended motion.
Yes, it's alleged in the amended motion that both of them pled guilty open on the day of the plea
based on the advice of counsel.
Correct. Also, quoting Holloway v. Arkansas, the evil of dual representation is what in counsel is compelled to refrain from doing. Now here, we know it was possible for counsel to have negotiated a plea deal for Natalie's testimony against David. But counsel did not negotiate a plea, and there's nothing on the record indicating that he even attempted to do so. And why? Because he couldn't. There is also an indication in the record that the prosecuting attorney wouldn't have just have continued to make package plea deals, and he indicated that he would make a separate plea deal for Natalie's testimony against David in the instance where counsel was not representing both Natalie and David. So the prosecutor indicated that if counsel didn't represent Natalie, that he would, in fact, make a separate plea offer to her, which would have been or could have been more advantageous. These were alternatives that were objectively reasonable that counsel did not utilize or explore. Respondent seems to suggest that the prejudice that we have to establish is that under Strickland. But for the conflict of interest, there is a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. But what we have to show is that there were plausible alternative choices and tactics that counsel could have utilized and employed that were objectively reasonable that he didn't employ or explore because of the conflict of interest. So in other words, we have to show, but for the conflict of interest, there is a reasonable probability that counsel's performance somehow would have been different. We have shown that in by stating that the conflict of interest adversely affected counsel's advice to Natalie and that he never talked to her about what he could do in her case separately, but only told her what he could do for both her and David. And we've shown that it affected his ability to negotiate plea offers and how he discussed those plea offers with her.
Thank you. Case is submitted.